Support for The Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars with West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com.
And you're on The Front Porch. This week, it's our post-primary breakdown. Who won, who was beaten, and who lost. Because in West Virginia politics, you actually have to spell out who was physically beaten and metaphorically beaten. Also, we'll discuss, am I a parasite? The attitude that really holds West Virginia back. Joining me is Rick Wilson, goat herder, hillbilly philosopher, and Lori Lynn, lawyer, queen of the Twitter burn, and cicada lover. Hey, Lori.
Hi, guys.
All right, let's start with this incident in Logan County, the beating, the physical beating of a state Senate candidate, Richard Ojeda, who ended up going on to win the race against a longtime incumbent, entrenched political figure in Logan County named Art Kirkendall.
This is really unusual. I mean, Logan County has some, you know, is known for, we can, shall we say, colorful politics, but this is unusual. And the other thing, like, I've seen Ojeda in action, and the other person had to catch him off guard because he is pretty fit, pretty tough. I would not want to roll with that guy. So in a fair fight, I don't think it would have happened. Apparently, they've known each other for a long time, which is what you'd expect. But there's a great saying. I think one of the McGraws might have said it. I'm not sure who. But this is like, everyone should know this. In West Virginia, everything's political except politics, and that's personal. Mm-hmm. And then I also heard there might have been some flameouts on Facebook.
There were.
Some flameouts before it happened.
Ojeda posted a whole bunch of documents. Kirkendall was being paid by the county commission as a consultant even after he left the county commission. Something like $2,500 a month.
Yeah, which is quite a bit of money.
It is quite a bit of money for consulting. A good investigative journalist ought to go down there and find out what was the work product
for
that.
Great idea.
Rick, you have some stories about Logan County politics and how that works. Why don't you share those with us?
Yeah, I don't want to pick on Logan County because West Virginia in general has some interesting ones. But I talked to a friend from there about the, you know, different things that happened. A lot of this is apocryphal. It could be legendary, but first of all, the major incident in the Hatfield-McCoy feud was a stabbing that took place at an election that was not in Logan County. I think Devillance moved back to Logan in later years. This was, I think, in Kentucky. You know, there's a going back and forth there. Two, in the 30s, this is something my friend was told as a kid. It was a presidential election. There were paper ballots. The election wasn't going someone's way, so he threw up on the paper ballots, so they had to be thrown out. I don't know if that really happened, but that's a story. Another one. This one, I think, is really true. When Kennedy was running, people asked a political boss down there what it would cost to win the election, and he said 35, and he meant 3,500, but he got 35,000, as the story goes. He didn't realize how things roll. In the late 60s, early 70s, several people went to jail, the Logan Five, for a voting machine. I don't have all the details.
Including Governor Tomlin's father?
That's what I heard. I don't know. Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the Supreme Court election, the first nonpartisan election. Beth Walker, who was a lawyer who had a lot of support and a lot of money, frankly, coming in from GOP groups, walked away with it with a pretty good margin, 39% against four other candidates, including the one that the GOP was worried about, Daryl McGraw, the former attorney general.
Well, I was a little bit surprised by how handily she won. I think a lot of people were surprised that it really was not that close at all. There's been a lot of talk about, was it really nonpartisan? I think there's some misunderstanding, some deliberate misunderstanding about what exactly the nonpartisan part of this meant. There's a nonpartisan ballot, which means there's no D's or R's next to anyone's name. The law certainly does not prevent parties from supporting candidates, from saying good or bad things about candidates. In fact, there would be huge First Amendment problems with any law that tried to do that. So the fact that the Republicans are congratulating her now does not mean that the election was actually a partisan election.
What about the role of money in this? You know, a lot of Democrats are saying that this is all about a ton of money that was dropped on this race, and that's why Walker won this time when she lost in 2008. Do you agree?
Well, first of all, she worked really, really hard. She was campaigning for 11 months. She went to Rotary Club dinners. You know, she was really, really out there working. So certainly you have to give her some credit for that. Obviously, money did play a part in it. She needed to get her name ID up. Daryl McGraw has very good name ID. So, you know, I don't fault her one single bit. I think the best candidate won. And again, I would point out the left had this in the bag if it had just been Wooten, right? Justice Benjamin was always going to take some amount of support away from Walker. So you could have had, if McGraw hadn't slid into the race at the very last minute, one left candidate versus two right candidates. And I think Wooten would have had a very good chance, no matter how much money Walker had spent. And if you looked at, Wooten did get quite a bit. If you added what he and McGraw got together, that candidate would have won. So
another race where this came into play, this idea of splitting a vote, was the Democratic gubernatorial primary. Former Senate President Kessler, the former Attorney General Goodwin, and you had the billionaire Jim Justice. And Jim Justice ended up getting slightly more than half of the vote, and the other two anti-justice candidates split the vote.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we always do a biblical verse on here, and I got an email from someone. When you guys recap the primary on the front porch, mention the judgment of King Solomon, who ruled that the baby should be split in half in order to find out who the real mother was. Unfortunately, neither Kessler or Goodwin agreed to step aside in order to save the baby. And now we get Justice, irony intentional. Now, this is not me. I'm reading an email I got from some other people, but I think it clearly did divide the vote. I think a lot of people really felt torn about which way to go on that.
West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glennis Board did sort of an exit interview with Jeff Kessler this morning. Really great. So Kessler saying basically, I can't stand to be in the legislature anymore.
It's hard to be in the minority.
That's right. He wasn't going to back down. And why do you think Goodwin was so determined to run in this gubernatorial election?
I think Goodwin had it gamed out that he was going to prosecute Don Blankenship. He was going to convict him. He was going to put him away for several years. It was going to be a big PR boost for him. It sort of worked out that way. I think not as well as he had hoped. And then I think what he did not foresee was Jim Justice getting into the race. I think if it had been Kessler Goodwin, Goodwin, I think, almost certainly would have won.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. We're going to take a break, and in just a minute, we're going to see whether there were some quote-unquote dirty tricks in the second congressional race for the Democratic side. And we will talk more about whether I am a parasite. More in a minute.
Okay, so, Front Porchians, did you know we have a West Virginia Public Broadcasting app?
I was not aware of that. Were you aware of that?
I was not aware.
Really? You're not just faking it? You really don't know?
I actually really did not know.
This is awesome. Okay, great. You have what sort of phone?
An iPhone.
Here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to the App Store.
The App Store.
And if you have an Android phone,
here we are.
Then you want to go to Google Play, but in this case, the App Store. You want to search for WVPB, like West Virginia and peanut butter.
Okay, media app. I see it.
Okay.
Oh, even Rick is figuring this out.
Loveo.
All right,
ooh,
download
I like
it,
the
please.
Logo. Very nice. Get. It's free, right?
It is totally free.
So hit get. Okay.
I see news and I see podcasts is the second choice, and there's the front porch right there.
Click on the little computer screen in the middle there, and what you'll see is all of our videos. You can watch Masterpiece, you can watch Nova.
And there's
here.
A donate button right there.
Oh,
at the
and
top.
Wow, I didn't even have to ask you to do that. Yes, there's a red donate now button in the upper right-hand corner as well. And then finally, there's a whole tab for Mountain Stage. You can listen to and watch all of your favorite Mountain Stage performances. Please download it and make it the way you listen to The Front Porch and all your favorite programs.
Okay, we're back. I had a tweet from a guy called Chip Douglas, and I'm going to treat it seriously. I'm not going to treat it like a troll because he's a serious person. It started when I put out an article by a guy called Jedediah Purdy. He's a law professor. He's also an author. And he is from Calhoun County. He was born there. His parents are back to the Landers. Grew up there, and he put out an essay, kind of his analysis of the election. I strongly recommend you go to our website, wvpublic.org. We'll have a link to it there, where he basically said West Virginians are neither socialists nor are they racists, which is why people are saying we voted for Sanders and Trump in such large numbers. That's more complicated than that. And what we really are is, quote unquote, the bleeding edge of inequality in America today. I thought it was an interesting thing. I put it out there. Yeah, I get this quote back, and I'm going to read it to you verbatim. It says, Radio Finn, that's me, and Jedediah Purdy, neither of you are actually from West Virginia, and I really resent this bullshit. Fucking parasites. Doesn't matter whether you choose to move here or your parents were back to the Landers. Either way, exporting those stereotypical stories is condescending. Who are you selling this to? So I won't take you seriously. I'm going to actually try to answer your question. We talked about this idea that some people seem to have, that if you could just put a wall around the state of West Virginia and just keep everybody here and keep out everybody else, that this would be paradise. And this is a very unique idea. This is not something that you see in Tampa or Washington, D.C. It leads to the question, who's a real West Virginian? So Representative Alex Mooney, who was run against for being a quote-unquote carpetbagger, and it appears that they're going to use that again and try to label him as someone who doesn't deserve to be here. He's not a real West Virginian. So people who moved here recently, are they West Virginians? If not, then okay, what about me? I moved here 20 years ago. People who moved here 20 years ago, am I a West Virginian? What about people who are born here, but their parents were from someplace else?
So that's the case with Jed Purdy, right?
That's the case of Jed Purdy.
He was born here.
And his parents were back to the Landers. You know, that's what Chip said. Well, okay, maybe it's only back to the Landers children that aren't really West Virginians. Or maybe it's anyone who came here. My wife was born here in West Virginia. Her father has roots going back a long way in Gilmer County, but her mother's from Pennsylvania. So is she only really half West Virginian? What about people who immigrated here from other countries? What about the Indians and Pakistanis and Filipinos that are doctors? Are they parasites? Are their children West Virginians if they're not? What about people whose grandparents came here and great-grandparents? What about authors like Denise Giardino? What about Joe Manchin? Are they West Virginians? What about the blacks whose ancestors came up from the Deep South after slavery to work in our coal mines? Are they West Virginians? Or is it only really the first groups of white settlers who came over the hills and established the first settlements, and by the way, chased away whatever Indians were left here after disease and war, and their descendants? Are they the only real West Virginians? And my argument is that this is the real problem with this state. At the end of the day, we can talk about health, we can talk about education, we can talk about lots and lots of different things. But at the root core of it, if you don't have a free flow of ideas and people and money in this state, and just like it's okay for people who grew up in West Virginia to want to leave, it's perfectly okay. They shouldn't have to leave, but they should feel like they can leave. It should be equally okay, and not just okay, it should be welcomed that other people want to come here. And it's not just racism, although there's a racist aspect to some of this when people say they don't want immigrants here. You know, there's a reason why we're the state with the fewest foreign-born people in America, and part of it's jobs. But if this is what you get for moving here, this questioning of whether you belong here or not, how are we ever going to be able to have the sort of depresses me?
Well, also, the characterization of you as a parasite, you know, even if you're an outsider, how are you a parasite? You live here, you have a very productive job, you're the leader of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
I took someone else's job.
Which some people think should be privatized.
Always have to bring
that
up.
Never going to forget that.
That's true. Okay, so then you are parasitic in that sense. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay, though. I think that would be... I'm trying to figure it out. I think it's because I'm coming in and taking a job from a real West Virginian that could run it. And so it's this... It goes back to our discussion on Logan County a little bit in politics, I think. It's a very scarce view of the world. There's a limited amount of stuff. And a limited amount of people that can get the stuff. And I come in as an outsider. I'm just there to take your stuff.
But is it...
Your jobs and your land and everything else. I understand there's historical precedent for this. I know why that is in the West Virginia psyche. But it doesn't stop me from being tired of it. Very, very tired of it. And I know that there are... Everyone who's listening, I know that most of you don't feel this way. I mean, I'm not indicting every single person who's a West Virginia native. Of course not. But this is not the first time this has come up. This is not the first time we've had this conversation about outsiders.
So I used to be really hardcore. I'm just going to fess up about this. Like, for me, it used to be the big three: born, raised, and educated, which incidentally, wow, trifecta right here talking. But but I've lightened up. You know, like Malcolm X used to think all white people were devils, then he went to Mecca and realized that all white people weren't devils, just some of them. So I'm like Malcolm. I've gotten over that. You know, I try to be open and tolerant, you know, to people who come here from other places.
Now, how far back do your roots go, Rick?
That's a good, well, you know, there's right across the border in Tazewell, which is right next to McDowell, probably Revolutionary War kind of things, okay, like that. And so I'm not sure about all the different branches, at least several back anyway, some in the coal fields. But the other thing, you know, if you look at West Virginia history, you know, sometimes there's a place for xenophobia. And I'm not talking about everyone that comes here. I'm just saying, you know, certain things have happened over the centuries that have probably made people leery. But I think in a way, in this world, we need people to come here now. We're losing population. We're getting old. You know, someone needs to come here and take care of us. And there's all this scientific data that is, the social capital is what you need. And it's connections with people who are different from you, who don't know the same things you know, that's really going to help pull it out. So I'm still have a little bit of an Appalachian nationalist in my soul, but I've tried to dial it down a little bit.
Yeah, I totally hear what you're saying. I mean, if your history, personal family history, is that at some point some lawyer comes in from Philadelphia and tricks your family into giving up their mineral rights, and that's something that's been passed down from generation to generation, then yeah, I get where it's coming from. But I think it's become counterproductive. It's become the sort of scar that ends up hurting the entire state and holding it back. And I think that it's something that we as leaders of the state need to address more openly and start talking about. And if increasingly our children in certain communities in West Virginia are more isolated, I think we need to make an extra effort to use technology and other ways to open up their minds to the wide world that's out there.
And the other half of it you alluded to, not only it's about hostility to people coming in, but it's about the idea that you shouldn't leave. And we've talked about this a lot of times also. You know, it's very limiting to tell a kid at 15 or 16 that he's doing something wrong if he's looking at out-of-state colleges, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we really should not be doing that either.
I had a dream once that maybe speaks to this situation. And, you know, some dreams are just static. They're just stuff. This one's kind of deep, you know, and this may be a plot of some of the stuff we need to let go of if those of us who are native West Virginians with an attitude like me. In the dream, I was going through a period when I felt like I'd been wrong, and I was going around carrying a casket with me with empty bones in it. I'd carry around everywhere I went because it was important. But then at some point in the dream, I realized I had a lot of places I needed to go and things I needed to do. So I was like, oh, I guess I ought to put this shit down. And I woke up and said, whoa, that was a cool dream. So, you know, you don't need to lose your edge, West Virginia, but we probably need to let go of some stuff.
I do feel fortunate to be here. I feel lucky that this is the place that I landed. It's been great for me. It's been allowed me to meet wonderful people, my wife, my friends, have a great career. And I've devoted my entire life to loving a place that I adopted. But I consider that love to be just as important as people who love their adopted children. You know, it's no different. And I just think that we need to work on making sure that everybody who wants to choose to be in West Virginia feels welcome here.
You come in here from out of town. Say you've come to shut us down.
We had this real interesting situation in the 2nd Congressional District. That's represented by Alex Mooney. He's been there 2 years. Some people see him as a carpetbagger because he just came in a couple of years ago from Maryland, and he won in a huge Republican year by only 3 points. So 5 Democrats were up to try to challenge him in this cycle. And the one that won is a former state delegate and lawyer, Mark Hunt. Let's just say some Democrats are worried he might not have been the strongest candidate. The person that some people saw as a stronger candidate was a lawyer and veteran called Corey Simpson. He had the support of national Democrats, but he lost. And the allegation here is that Alex Mooney sent out a flyer a few days before the election, quote-unquote, attacking Hunt, attacking him in a way that would make Democrats want to vote for him. It's kind of like what happened with the Senate race in Missouri, where incumbent Senator Claire McCaskill successfully baited Republicans in the primary into electing Todd Akin as her opponent, exactly the one she wanted to run against. He said some very controversial things about rape and abortion, and then she won. So my question to you all is, has the Democratic Party been Akin'd here?
I don't know if I would say it's dirty. It's pretty clever in my book. The Democratic establishment is certainly pretty annoyed, I think, right now. They were really hoping to have Simpson. And as you hinted, Scott, Mooney, I think, is the weakest of the three Congress people. But yeah, a Charleston lawyer is exactly who you don't want to run against Alex Mooney. What you really need is someone from the panhandle, someone with a lot of support, where the votes are. I just don't think a Charleston lawyer is going to cut it.
Especially a Charleston lawyer who actually lost his 2014 race for the State House of Delegates.
In judo, there's this thing called kazushi. It's where you push a certain direction in order to get your opponent to pull, or vice versa, and then use that to break the balance so that you can execute a technique. So seemed like there might have been some kazushi on this one. I didn't follow this race closely, but sounds like.
And again, it was another race where there were five candidates. So, you know, and you saw this play out in the Republican primary for president this year. You know, lots of just, well, if only you would get out of the race, I would have a clear path. There was this, you know, Rubio and Kasich and Cruz. And, you know, that's just not really how politics works.
I have no evidence for this, but I'm going to put it out there anyway. It seems like the parties have less power at the national and the state level to basically force people out of the race. The exception to that, though, is the state Republican Party, which has done a pretty darn good job of making sure that, for example, Bill Cole is the only person running for governor on their side and uniting around him.
Will Rogers used to say, I'm not from an organized political party, I'm a Democrat. So I don't know.
Well, whatever happened, West Virginians were really excited to turn out to vote. This time around, you know, we were talking a lot about the state's record low voter turnout in previous elections. Not so this time. 40% turnout for a primary, which is higher than historically over the last couple of primary elections, and pretty darn good. So what's going on there?
Yeah, we had people waiting in line, even, you know, voting even way past when the polls had closed because there were such long lines. I think a lot of it was excitement about Trump. I think you have to attribute probably most of it to that.
Obviously, even though Trump told people that they didn't have to come out and vote after all.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. Right. But it will be interesting to see how that relates to the turnout in November, if it is equally higher. I mean, it should be higher, but if it's proportionally higher.
Also, I think a lot of young people really, you know, enthusiastic about Sanders, you know, and they showed up. And we don't have that many young people in the state, but that might have been a factor, too, and you don't know whether that enthusiasm will be there in November.
Amazing stuff on the Democratic side. I mean, we did a whole show about this. You should go back and listen to it. But Hillary Clinton, just all sorts of weakness in West Virginia. A third, and according to exit polls, a third of the Democrats who voted said that they would vote for Trump. You can't have any hope of winning West Virginia at all when you start with those sorts of numbers. Speaking of what's going on out there right now, we have a whole bunch of cicadas in my backyard. There are these huge insects. They look very menacing and black and dark and scary. The scientists say that they are harmless and even good for the environment.
They just want sex, Scott.
That's right. They just want to mate.
Every 17 years, right? Is that the life cycle? They live at the base of my tree for 17 years.
In a larval kind of form. They don't look the way they look now. But yeah, then they come out and emerge and eat a lot and mate and then lay the eggs for the next generation.
You've talked a lot about cicadas. You posted some pictures of them on Facebook.
Yeah, I really want to do a cicada of the day, you know, every day. I plan to lose all kinds of followers.
What is it about cicadas that fascinate you?
Oh, I think it's so interesting. You know, this animal that lurks underground that really is barely alive for 17 years. And how do they know? You know, how is it? Obviously, they don't know. But how does nature know that it's now time? 17 years is just such a long time. How do they get it right over and over again?
You did some research on why 17 years, right?
Well, 17 is a prime number. So cicadas have predators, birds, and other small animals that have kind of natural cycles. Like every 3 or 4 years, the birds will have a boom year. What the cicadas need to do is to time their big year, because they have their big year occurs so rarely. They need it to not occur at the same time as a big year for their natural predators. And so some scientists ran a computer simulation. What would be the best number for this? They came up with 13 and 17, which are exactly the numbers of the periodical cicadas. Most of them here on the East Coast are 17 years, but there are some 13-year broods. And so, you know, those are two prime numbers that allow their big years to coincide as little as possible with their predators. And what they do, what people think the long period does, is it overwhelms the predators. There's so many cicadas that the birds can't possibly eat them all. So, and it's a good year for birds. It's a good year for caterpillars, because the birds are concentrating so much on the cicadas that they don't eat the caterpillars. So then you have the caterpillars. It's really fascinating to me, but also a little bit gross and smelly when they all die, and not looking forward to that. Also noisy.
I'm not a big bug eater. You know, I did eat one in Mexico once, but if I had to eat a bug, cicadas would probably be on the short list, you know. If I had to go, it might be like popcorn. I don't know.
I have no idea why you went there.
But you said you don't have them where you live, right?
No, I live where I live, it's a different crop, the 91-2008 cicadas. So it's like a different high school class.
And it looks like from the map, the southern part of the state is getting spared.
Yeah, also, they're part of the group that I belong to. Okay. Yeah, like I'm south of Route 60, y'all, okay. Represent. So I'm glad you mentioned prime numbers. There's something I'd like to share. Anytime I'm in any setting where someone says, are there any questions, I always want to raise my hand and say, how many prime numbers are there between 1 and 10,000? Just to be a jerk, you know. But sometimes I do, sometimes I don't.
I was going to ask you all, what sort of metaphor you think cicadas are for our lives? And when you talked about a brood being so large that it overwhelmed the predators, I thought about mass protests and people power, and this idea that for good or for ill, that if you have enough people that are determined to do something, it doesn't matter what the power structure wants. You can overwhelm it.
For me, the metaphor is like, you know, their real life is kind of underground if you look at it in terms of quantity. And so some of the most important parts of life are passed unseen that we're not even aware of. So that's something to think about. There's all kind of stuff going on that we don't even see. We just see a little bit of it. So.
What were you doing 17 years ago?
Wow, that's a depressing thought. No, that is interesting. My mom, when they had the brood where she lived, she took a cicada, you know, the shell, they shed their shells and they have these brown shells, and she took a couple and put them in these little glass boxes for my kids and wrote stickers. You know, you were 2 years old the last time, you were three, you know, you'll be 20 the next time. So it's amazing to look at my little kids and think the next time we have an emergence of these bugs, my kids will be in college, which is incredible to think about.
I had no kids. I'd just gotten married, 1999, and just transitioning from being a Vista worker and doing nonprofit work into becoming a journalist. Wow. And in 17 years, it feels like so much has happened. And 17 years is about how long it takes from a baby to be born to being an almost independent adult.
Ready to head off to college.
Your son will be, a junior in high school or something like that when the next brood.
The one who was just
born, yeah. Mm-hmm. We do have, I think, a poem.
We do.
About cicadas?
We do. It's a two-part poem, if someone wants to read one part of it. It's a dialogue between a cicada and a cricket, basically. So the cicada in this one is saying, "Cricket, please play for me. God, I'm so lustful right now. You know, come on. I need.
Let's do a little paraphrasing. Could you do the cicada, and then could Lori? Would you be willing to do the cricket?
And the cricket basically says, "Shut the hell up. You know, change your tune. I need a break and get over your madness." Okay, cicada to the cricket. Oh cricket, you who soothe my passion and provide the consolation of sleep. Oh cricket, shrill-winged rustic muse, you natural imitator of the lyre. Sing for me some poignant song as you tap your charming feet and strum your loquacious wings, so as to relieve me from toilsome worry that completely deprives me of sleep, as, O cricket, you spin out a song that dispatches Eros. Then shall I give you gifts, the first in the morning, an evergreen leek along with dewy droplets that I separate with my mouth.
O resonant cicada, drunk on dewy droplets, you sing your rustic song that sounds in lonely places. Perched with your saw-like limbs high up above the leaves, you shrill forth the lyra's tune with your sun-darkened body. But, dear friend, sound forth something new for the woodland nymphs, a diversion, chirping a tune for Pan as the song which you sing in your turn, so that I, escaping from Eros, can catch some noontime sleep while reclining there under the shady plane tree.
In other words, would you please shut up? I need some rest. So that poem
is like... I think we will
like,
all be saying that in cicada land here over the next few weeks.
That poem is like from the 2,000 years ago, ancient Greece.
Beautiful. Well, that's the front porch for this week. You've been listening to our Reader's Theater, which is Lori Lynn, conservative columnist, and Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Thanks for listening.
It's just not enough. Lovely.
My darling, I can't get enough of your love, babe. Girl, I don't know why I can't get enough of your love, babe. Lord, something.